Wet leg versus
self-esteem.
Self-esteem.
Very much team self-esteem.
Team self-esteem too, Mark.
Yeah, yeah. Wet leg, I mean, it's just a bit twee sometimes, isn't it?
it's a little bit twee. And also, Isla White.
I know.
Nothing good's happened on the island.
No. Do you know what the other thing is? I think, like, you know, when some people are like, I'm not from London and everything, I think, yeah, but I bet your mum and dad were.
Yeah.
And I get the feeling the Isle of Wight that they live in, different from the Isle of Wight most people live in. I'm basing that on nothing, other than the fact that obviously they've not had to get jobs and they've been making their own album. Right. How would you even go about making your own album?
Oh.
Unless you're doing it in your bedroom like Daniel Bedingfield, the only true artist, then it's all a bit, you know, we all get together and imagine saying to your mates, I need you for 3 days.
You can't do that.
It's just not possible.
Go to a recording studio in an hour.
Is your mum tall? Do you like to dance? It's not hard. I do like self-esteem.
Yeah,
I think, yeah, look, sense of humour. We all like a sense of humour.
Yeah.
But she's also, she brings the seriousness to those ridiculous beats.
Yes.
Hello. Welcome to
the Enemy Roundtable.
Wrestle Me. Amazing Wrestle Me still going in Enemy's fold, isn't it?
Yeah.
That seems wrong.
Saw that often.
Unlikely.
Didn't we?
Is that my phone? Do you know who that is?
Who's that?
That's the Lost Property people at the bus.
The Lost Profits? Yeah, go and answer it, quick.
I'm not fucking answering the Lost Profits.
Hi, a phone I sneaked in.
This is
a
phone call from a registered sex offender at... welcome back to Wrestle Me Again.
Have you printed your nuts on the back of a
That is a statutory reminder to get vehicle tax. That's the car there.
Nice.
Do you know what's really annoying? Very difficult to turn off duplex printing on HP when you're using a Mac.
So I printed
this 9 times and it kept and it on doing double sided.
Over the top of, because you're recycling of using the paper. But there's just, surely they picked off different, vastly different paper quality. So then you're battling against, the printer doesn't know what to expect.
Well, it doesn't, but I just don't want it to do both sides. There's no way of unticking it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know we're not talking about wrestling. I know we talked about Mark, wet leg, self-esteem, and now we're talking about duplex printing.
Mark, I'm fairly certain I did duplex printing last week on a Mac that I turned off and then turned back on again. So I'm maybe a different model in Stack Towers.
Did factory restore, you know, settings.
You restored to factory reset.
I didn't forget
your Wi-Fi.
I went bananas. I went absolutely bananas.
Scorched earth.
Didn't work. Had to print them out one at a time. Print current page. Wonderful. Printed out 2 number 11s. Absolutely furious. We go back to the King of the Ring 1995. Oh, what's this? Last night at the Philadelphia Marriott.
What?
The Hall of Fame induction ceremony.
Yes, please. They've slid this in for our delectation and entertainment. Yeah.
It's funny to remember that the Hall of Fame, they were just like, this is something we do, but we've got to sort of announce it was there, but no one cares.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stick it anywhere.
I do care too.
I want to see Ivan Putski and Razor Ramon threatening a kid in a wheelchair. I want to see that.
Worth remembering, and nobody mentioned this in his obits, but Scott Hall seemed to be absolutely brilliant with the kids when he was Razor Ramon. He appeared on the Jerry Springer Show with two kids who had got pediatric AIDS.
Right.
And he hugged them and kissed them at a time when people were still worried about AIDS and about proximity with people who suffered from it.
He was their Princess Diana.
He was. I mean, you know, and you see him in this bit, and he's messing around with a kid in a wheelchair, and he just has no sense of doing anything but going, I'm going to make this really special for this young dude. Absolutely love that. Whereas Shawn Michaels is there, and everyone's just trying to get his autograph, and you can see he's just like, get me out of this sea of unfuckable people.
He's hanging out of a function room door, and he could not be less in the corridor.
Vince McMahon, again, just trying to do that thing of talking to the youth and being so far out of time with it. And he says, it's the Hall of Fame, all the stars of today turn up. It's like the first time your dad took you to a ball game, he says. A line they'd come up with in advance that they didn't really understand quite what it was.
Cracker Jacks and home runs.
Oh, everybody loves your Bam Bam Bigelow. What? why is Bam Bam Bigelow for kids? If you don't get it, look it up.
Fishing on a Sunday, just like Bob Backlund.
Mom's apple grapple. The people in the Hall of Fame this year are Moolah, the big cat Ernie Ladd, Ivan Putski, Polish Power, who sings a song that seemed to be called My Melody of Love.
Yeah, it was
No idea what he's doing in
there. I thought he was going to sing like a foreign song, but it was very English.
It was.
It's just confusingly English.
Completely unwanted, but perfectly pleasant.
But he sort of stood up and he was sort of like, oh, he's going to sing the national anthem of You Are the Wind Beneath My Wings. What?
I want to sex you up. George Animal Steel also inducted here.
Rubbing his little plaque on his face because he's an animal.
A big forgotten bit as well where he's inducted by Bill Murray on an elephant.
Bill Murray on the back of an elephant wants George Animal Steel to, and then he does a little skit that he's going to take George Steel.
I'm going to, you animal, you beast. He says, you creature. I absolutely adored it. It's just a shame it came in the week that Bill Murray has turned out to be problematic. I was like, at any other point in human history, I'd have gone, that's cool.
Oh, what? Has this happened?
Yes.
Oh.
They had to stop filming a film.
Oh.
Now, that seems like quite a big deal, doesn't it?
I think that it... I always thought...
Looking forward to hearing this.
With Bill Murray, you know when like people sort of talked about how celebrated he is as an improviser?
Yes.
It just always seemed like... A bit of a nightmare.
I know.
Dealing with him. I don't know what these allegations are. I'm sure I'll get to them. And it certainly amuses me that one of my friends does have a tattoo of the man.
Oh, what a living nightmare.
But he was asked at the time, do you regret having that? Because what if he comes... Because, you know, it's the age of the Gotchas. And he said, well, no, it's a character from the film. It's a character from Life Aquatic. So it's the Zizou
Oh, this is the TV host of a popular 80s British children's TV show. It's not... It's not what you think.
Well, he's going to be doing the WrestleMania karaoke night.
Oh, so there you go. good.
Tell him off there.
The Bill Murray thing, you know. I remember when he'd like turn up at students' parties and stuff.
Yeah,
and everyone would be like, "Look at him, isn't he hilarious?"
Did Grant do that as well?
Was he? I mean, if I did that, people would go, "Is that appropriate?"
I don't know.
Just because you're famous,
isn't he a free spirit?
Oh, right. It's appropriate because we know he is. Do you? Mm. Do you? The other inductees are mainly dead. There's Ernie Roth, who was the gay Jewish manager, the Grand Wizard, who was like a sort of space age sort of
his glasses
dude. Yes, that was as far as the space age went. Was just he had some glasses. You also get Antonino Rocca, who was a high flyer. Back in the 50s and 60s, they show his widow getting emotional in a speech, and it's otherwise a very dry ceremony, and you can see that they've taken that bit out and gone, you know, this is in some way some human emotion that we will monetize. That is good. They mention that Moolah is as beautiful and gracious as ever. Not sure she was either. Not sure anyone ever thought she was gracious. The only person who isn't there who was alive, who was inducted, was Pedro Morales.
Right.
Former WWF champion, or WWWF champion, who was a Puerto Rican, and he was very much in New York in the 70s, lots of Puerto Ricans, and WWE liked to book ethnic champions. Bruno Sammartino appealed to the Italian-Americans, and they'd fill out Madison Square Garden. And they did the same with Pedro Morales. He was a very big, you know, hit at the time. But he's, to this day, the only living inductee who was not present for his or her induction in the WWF Hall of Fame.
Right.
At the time, he was a Spanish language announcer for WCW. And so it's believed that he didn't turn up because he didn't want to cause any friction with his employer at the time. What's unusual is that WWF still went ahead with it. You know, I think it was unusual they decided to rubber stamp that when he's working for the opposition.
Yeah.
Interesting little trivia bit that nobody mentions. Match number 5, the semi-final of the King of the Ring. It's Savio Vega versus the Roadie.
He's back again.
I mean, the crowd They're could not be less invested in this. This is the third time that night that the crowd have seen Savio Vega. It's the second time for the Roadie.
Yeah.
Everyone is beginning to... It's beginning to sink in. They're going, why are we watching this shit?
You know,
what is the point of this? The match is what it is. There's a good pop at the end where Vega pushes Roadie into Jeff Jarrett, but Roadie stops. He manages to stop before he crashes, and as he turns, Vega hits him with a knee, bounces into Jeff Jarrett, and Vega does a roll up for the pin, and that does get a big pop. It might be as much anything relief that time is moving forward and these things are being ended. And
they seem to ramp it up for this match. I was like, okay, fine. Okay, is it going to get better? I mean, it doesn't get better. Nothing gets better.
No, they have a little bit where they bring out I'm going to cough because I want to say his name. It's a foreign name and I don't wish to like choke in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Like I'm disgusted by not speaking English. Carlos Cabrera comes in and he does a little Spanish interview with Savio Vega. Again, something quite unusual by WWF standards. And when you're in a town like Philadelphia, there is a sense of going, it's a mistake to play up the wrestler's otherness and say he is not like you in some way on a very sort of like, you know, basic level. What happens is they put in Michael Hayes, Doc Hendricks, to give try and false, comedy it up.
Yeah, to give some false translation.
Yeah.
The joke is Michael Hayes has no idea what this is being said, but he does a false translation.
He says, I'll never be able to beat Mabel. I'm going to quit stealing hubcaps. And Doc Hendricks totally misjudges the time that this is going on. So he gets out a load of his stupid stuff. He turns around and goes, he says, Mabel's going to beat me very quickly. I'm going to give up stealing hubcaps. And then there's a bit where he sort of goes, this is 3 minutes of talking Spanish. And Doc Hendricks is just stuck there for the last minute going,
he's got nothing. He's gassed out.
Fucking it.
What?
The walls feel like they're closing in. They're closing
one
in.
Of wrestling's great talkers.
What's a bodega? I work in. No. horrible moment. Next match, number six, is Bret Hart versus Jerry Lawler in a Kiss My Foot match.
Yeah. Earlier, when Jerry Lawler is being interviewed in the locker room and he's showing off his dirty sock, next to him, there's two papier-mâché big feet, cartoon feet.
Oh,
yeah. And he never mentions them. It never gets used anywhere else. There's just two papier-mâché feet that they've made.
He was supposed to have like an artificial foot
on. I don't know.
That looked disgusting.
I don't know.
But he was like, well, there's no way I can get the boot on.
It's clearly in the shot. It's really confusing.
That is great. That is great.
It's a really weird
thing. I love stuff where you see ideas that have gone nowhere, but somehow they've accidentally left them on telly. Amazing. This is an okay match. There was always a real big problem with Jerry Lawler as... He is a great heel on the mic. He is one of those guys who is so good at the art of professional wrestling when it comes to talking in a microphone.
Yeah.
But the problem is he didn't have the build of a WWF heel. He was very, very good at all the riling up the crowd. And the crowd wanted to see him get beaten. But the problem is you knew when he went up against Bret Hart, he didn't stand a chance.
Yeah.
And that was always one of the big problems with these matches. The only time that he'd beat Hart would be he would cheat to win. But it wouldn't be a thing where it could go either way. Mm. You were just waiting either for the denouement, which would be Lawler cheating and getting a cheap victory, or eventually the natural order of things happening and Bret Hart tapping him out with a sharpshooter that was applied much too strong. Always a funny thing about Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler, Jerry Lawler talked about years later. Jerry Lawler did all of his stuff and he would just spend ages on television, week after week, talking about how stupid Bret Hart was, how ugly he was, how stupid his family was, how his mother was basically on death's door, how his father was, you know, a moron, a caveman, elderly, stupid. And the problem was Bret Hart, I think, found it quite difficult to go, he's just doing his job. And Bret Hart would take it a bit to heart.
Yeah.
So many years later, there are a couple of incidents, you know, where they'd had at the King of the Ring 93, Lawler had attacked Bret Hart after he'd won, and he'd hit him really hard with the throne in the ribs. And Bret Hart, when he took him on at SummerSlam 93, put him in the sharpshooter much too hard and much too long to teach him a lesson. So throughout the whole thing, Jerry Lawler does his job as best he can, and Bret Hart gets rankled by it and then decides to hurt him legitimately. And that's what happens in this match. Lawler does his job really, really well. And what happens is eventually Hart wins, and he makes Lawler kiss his foot. And he really puts his foot into Lawler's mouth. The funny thing about your foot is you don't have a great deal of control over it.
No.
And imagine you've wrestled for 20 minutes. You know, you're a bit sort of like, you know, all my muscles
tighten
are all going
up. Yeah.
And he's just pushing his bony foot into Lawler's mouth. And he's trying to get it deeper in. And Lawler's trying to sort of act, but at the same time, not have it touch the back of his throat. And it's so unfair to really sort of like grind it in.
Yeah.
Then Bret Hart makes Lawler kiss his own foot.
Yeah.
Lawler's foot is, it looks in the shot like it's his hand.
Because it's kind of like...
so far up and so far in his own mouth that Bret Hart is just like, I'm going to fucking twist this in. I'm going to crunch it in.
That's Tony Atlas's music.
Lawler is thoroughly beaten in this. What this ends up being is Lawler has had his own foot in his mouth and it's so rancid, he has to go and see a specialist doctor, a dentist rather, who will be Isaac Yankum DDS. And that is the introduction of Kane. So he comes in as the evil dentist, Isaac Yankum,
right.
Lawler's dentist. And I did like the fact that it was joined up, you know, that Lawler's foot is so rancid, he has to go to see this specialist dentist who is weird. And then that guy ends up wrestling Bret Hart at SummerSlam. I like the joined up little thing. Lawler and Hart, I mean, really, Lawler's only proper WWE feud was with Bret Hart, and it lasted for 2 years. It began at SummerSlam, at King of the Ring 93, and it carried on going through. It had been due to restart at Survivor Series 1994. Again, they are repeating feuds because there are so few heels around. Mm. There's no one who they can feed to Bret Hart who, you know, like Lawler is very good at setting up that angle. But maybe there's no one else they can bring in.
Maybe that's a literal feeding him the heel.
Yes.
Yeah, just the graphics on that is just horrible.
They put a big verruca in the middle of the foot on the match graphic as well. The interesting thing about that was, of course, that the feud was interrupted because Lawler had to take a leave of absence after allegations were made against him in regard to child exploitation. And at the time, he went very public about it. And his basic thing was, this case had sort of come out of nowhere because two girls had bragged about having sex with him and it was entirely made up. Mm. And he said that the prosecutor, who he singled out, had just wanted to get her face on TV as the reason why the case had kept going, even after Lawler's lawyer had claimed that both girls had recanted the story entirely. That is not quite what happened. In December 93, in the Pro Wrestling Torch, Wade Keller, the editor, had asked Jerry Lawler if he wanted to say anything about the case that he'd not already expressed publicly. And Lawler had said this, and this was always his story. I think it was made to sound so much worse than it was, when the only way it's reported is Jerry Lawler is charged with rape, when in actuality, all it is, here's a young girl who goes to wrestling who claimed to a friend of hers that she had sex with Jerry Lawler. I mean, how many groupies or girls who go to wrestling have claimed to have sex with the wrestlers? Millions. And this just got through to the wrong individual. Well, David Bixenspan, the journalist, a number of years later, he wrote for Deadspin, a really good article, and he went through the files that he'd gained about the police investigation through a Freedom of Information request. And it's a very, very different story. Two girls did claim that Lawler, after the wrestling at the Louisville Gardens, had approached them and said, why don't you come back to my hotel? The girls had been totally willing. Lawler had changed his mind, according to his accusers, and had then arranged to meet them the following morning outside the Louisville Gardens in his car. The girls skipped school and they went in his car. He took them to a hotel. They said they entered the hotel. He took his clothes off immediately. There was masturbation and oral sex while cartoons played on a television in the background. Mm. They said that Lawler then took them to Value City, which was a mall, and onto the Taco Bell, and then he dropped them off outside the Louisville Gardens at 2 o'clock, which enabled them to get back home, and it made it look as if they'd been to school that day. So that was the question. That was the accusations that were levelled against him by the girls and reported to the police. Lawler did a couple of interviews. Those interviews were part of the bundle of papers that David Bixenspan got. He talked a lot about the Value City where they went. He said the girls had been to his hotel room, but nothing had happened. He said he did take them to the local Value City. He told the police he always goes to a specific store at the Value City because they have an unbelievable buy on a certain kind of washing detergent there. Like huge things, like $3. And in Memphis, it's like $12. And so every time I've gone by, I've gone back there. I bought like three of them. So I've gone back there to see if they ever had any more of them, he says. There's a lot of these bits where he wants to tell you a lot of detail about things that don't really have any relevance to what the police were asking him about. He was spotted at the Value City with the two girls by a witness who was a wrestling fan and got his autograph. It was another witness came forward to say that he had seen the two girls outside of the wrestling arena that Wednesday morning. And so the girls had been there. And the hotel reported that, yes, indeed, on the night in question, Jerry Lawler had stayed at that hotel. Lawler said he knew the girls. He described them as arena rats to the police. The girls said that Lawler was aware of their ages, which were 14 and 15. But he denied anything happened. There was a little bit before the case went public. Lawler had called the girls' homes, where he ended up speaking to at least one of them and or their mothers. The person who isn't identified, who had informed the police about that call, said that Lawler had said they were the key to his getting out of this, and what she needed to do was lie and say that nothing happened. One of the girls maintained that everything that she had said was true, but she was unsure if she wanted to pursue the case in the light of Jerry Lawler's call. In another later interview, one of the mothers had said that Lawler rang and had said if she believed he'd violated the girls, then she should speak to his lawyer and not the police. And the police just wanted to make a name for themselves and they would be on to the next big case as soon as that one came about. And when he was interviewed by the police, Lawler admitted the girls were in his hotel room. He said nothing untoward had taken place and he'd not picked them up. They just turned up at his door. And he then said that one of the girls had admitted that she was lying about the story when he'd spoken to her on the phone and that he had taped her doing so. Now, when he was asked to produce those tapes, the police report says that Lawler became flustered.
Right.
He then said she'd not exactly admitted to lying, but indicated that on the conversation. After being asked on two subsequent occasions to supply those tapes to the police, Lawler's lawyer told the police that he was in fact not turning those tapes over to the police and stated he was not going to allow us to hear them, nor would he turn them over to us. As for the issue of whether the girls recanted their accusations, the retired Louisville detective Mike Redmond, who worked on the case, told Deadspin they never did. Instead, they refused to testify against Lawler. Redmond's interpretation of that decision being that the girls didn't want Jerry Lawler to get into trouble. So on February the 23rd, 1994, Lawler copped a plea for harassing a witness who was said to be a female other than the complainants, and the sex crime charges against him were dismissed. One of Lawler's attorneys said the girl's reluctance to testify was a factor in the deal being made. It's a fascinating article, the Deadspin article. What it is one of those things that people, you know, laugh about. And actually, it's a horrible, concerning case.
Right.
It's often been, one of the strangest things that happened was, 2017, someone had tweeted a picture of Pro Wrestling Illustrated Weekly when the story broke. And the headline on it was Lawler indicted on rape and sodomy charges. The sodomy charge was actually oral sodomy, which was the term that was given to oral sex by someone who was under the age of consent.
Yeah.
They tweeted, "Just found some hilarious pro wrestling content from my childhood in my parents' house at Jerry Lawler." And Jerry Lawler obviously didn't really see what it was and retweeted it.
Oh, wow.
Just a ridiculous thing to do. This story is one of those ones that is, with the passage of time, seemingly far more problematic. With what even laymen know about the way that people who are the victims of sexual assaults, you know, can essentially withdraw the confidence to pursue cases,
especially
the way that police handle it.
And it sounds like they were talked to by Jerry Lawler.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. It's not an appealing moment.
No.
And it's one of those things that, you know, we joke about him being a dirty old man and stuff. It is a horrible thing that lies underneath it, which even if he's entirely innocent of, it certainly is. There's some questionable decisions that have been made by Lawler in that time, even if it turned out they weren't criminal. He returned to the company in 1994 and was straight back into the position that he'd left, which, again, is a bit unsettling. Someone's holding up a sign that says, "Hey, Lawler, I got something you can kiss."
Right, okay.
Yeah. I hope it's a fucking adult, you know. it slightly hints that when you say, "I got something you can kiss," It slightly hints you can't say what it is. So it's it's the guy's butt or dick. Bret Hart in a very odd position in this feud as well. He is one of the biggest stars in the industry, but it's not clear where the WWF see him in the grand scheme of things. Mm. They want Shawn Michaels to be the number one big star. Diesel is being pushed as the champion. And Bret Hart is stuck wrestling Jerry Lawler, you know, who just spends ages talking about how stupid and dumb and smelly he is. I mean, it's a really odd position to be in. The match is fine. It's classic Jerry Lawler Memphis wrestling. It's a lot of riling up the crowd. Mm. It's a lot of low impact maneuvers. It's a match that you never ever need to see more than once. The issue being, of course, as I say, Lawler was never presented as an actual physical athletic threat in the WWF. Hart gets beaten up for most of the 10 minutes before he just locks that sharpshooter on, and he keeps it on for much too long. I mean, you know, always trying to hurt Jerry Lawler's back, which, I mean, you know, after the bit we've just been through, it's sort of hard not to sort of go, yeah, I hope it really hurt. He just twists him up, squishes him into a ball to kiss his own foot. And there we are. We have a little video about the Special Olympics. It's mentioned in this bit that a Special Olympian sang the national anthem at WrestleMania 11. That seems to have been snipped out.
I don't remember that. No, yeah, I think I would have remembered that. Yeah, I mean,
we can't have forgotten that. We can't have forgotten it because we talk about Rocking Robin being so bad.
Yeah, that's
and there would have been a
boat
where we'd gone, oh, it's a bit annoying. It was Special Olympian because you just have to go wonderful.
It's always a big feature. It's always a big feature. We always do the national anthem.
I'm worried how much more has been cut out. Sometimes when you go on Extreme Wrestling Torrents, people will put up, here is the pay-per-view stream of WrestleMania 6 or SummerSlam 92. And I've always looked at that and sort of gone, oh, mad completists. You know, what could you possibly? And I sort of go, maybe there's a lot.
They're always chomping stuff out.
What about if there's Bob Backlund president bits that
he became
have
the
fallen
president
by the wayside?
Bit.
Yeah, heartbreaking. we go to match 7, which is the King of the Ring finals between Mabel and Savio Vega.
Oh, thank God,
oh,
yes.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I mean, if the bear hugs by Mabel didn't make me fall asleep even more, it's just so... It was just like, why are we still doing it?
It's so hard to watch. The wonderful bit in this is we are in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, the fans have become interested in ECW. And in the front row are the most dedicated fans. And those are the fans who have discovered ECW first. In there is Hat Guy, famous guy who was front row of ECW every show.
Yeah.
And he is in the front row of this show. And credit to him, he isn't going, this is rubbish.
Yeah.
He is shouting really violently at every rule breaker. He is just a guy who loves wrestling. Well done on him. But what happens is, during this match, a sudden chant breaks out of ECW from the fans.
Right.
And Vince McMahon, after, you know, 2 hours of just everything dying in the room, they start going, ECW, ECW. And Vince McMahon suddenly goes, listen to this. And he suddenly realizes what they're saying. And he just has to go, right, carry on.
Don't listen to this.
Don't listen to that. Just let's get back to the match and stop being stupid. The public support is a new thing, really. You never heard chants of WCW at WWE events. And so suddenly you have this tiny organization that people are chanting for. Vince McMahon, credit to him, just listens and goes, okay, that's interesting. Mm. Why are they doing that? He would have a working relationship from this year on with Paul Heyman's ECW. There would be mini invasion type angles that took place in 1996 and 1997. So this may have been the moment that Vince McMahon realizes that this isn't just some temple organization. Mm. This is an organization that people will come to WWF and they will chant during one of his biggest matches of the year. Mm. And that's a fascinating little historical moment. Again, ECW, as we go into the Attitude Era, ECW becomes a real pioneer in what happens with WWF and WCW. Mm. Mo attacks Razor Ramon after we have this terrible, awful match, which Savio Vega loses. Mm. All of the non-existent steam coming out after this run of the underdog, the plucky underdog, who has had to fight 4 matches in a row, and then he goes up against Mabel, who's done 1, and Mabel wins. Mm. What was the point of any of this? It is funny to think that, like, you know, if you did that angle today, you probably would create a bit of a star. But here, people are just like, I don't care for anyone. Mm. I just do not like anyone. The attack on Razor Ramon, who has the legitimately injured ribs, Mabel goes up onto the second rope, and he has to sort of swing off to do an elbow drop. And it's one of those moves that is both really badly done and therefore looks quite brilliant. Because it's a bit out of control, and he doesn't really know what he's doing. And it looks crap and amazing. It's just the only way to describe it. Outruns the 1-2-3 kid, back from an injury. He kicks Mabel, then gets squashed. Again, why wasn't he on this show? Someone who can actually do something. Just astonishing. On comes the coronation for Mabel, and they stick the robes on him. And again, he's such a big man that when he puts the robes on, you destroy a bit of kayfabe. Because what they should have been is they should have been robes that were too small.
Yes.
And you then could have had him the following week going, you show me no respect. You know, bring forth my robes. And there's another 10 minutes of pointless television. Instead, he has these robes which fit him.
Yeah.
Anyone else would have been drowned in
it. Yeah. So you made the big robes just for him.
So you thought that either Mabel or Yokozuna were going to win. That's what you're saying. Just nuts. Mo reads the scroll. The only thing he does in this WWE run, hear ye, and he's doing it a bit too slowly because the fans' reaction is so big. It's genuinely negative. And I think Mo is thinking, this is great heat.
Yeah.
So what I'll do is I'll slow down and let him really whip himself into a frenzy. He slows down so much that Vince McMahon at one point just goes, oh, will he wrap it up? You know, there is just proper go-away heat. Mabel himself cannot stop almost smiling. And again, in a shoot interview, he was talking many years later and just going, wow, I mean, they really, the heat we got, they didn't realise what sort of heat it was. And it was the heat was fans rejecting what they were being given. One of the very few times in this period as well, where fans begin throwing rubbish at one of the wrestlers, and that's Mabel in the middle.
Yeah.
At one point, a beer can bonks off his head and everyone cheers. And Mabel, again, he says in the shoot interview, he said, I've wanted to smile with everybody else on that. And I think the problem is what you're seeing there is a total rejection of what he is. He isn't part of this thing where you're going, I'm doing what these people want.
Mm.
He was doing what the people didn't want. And I don't think he ever quite realised that. The fans get angry and angrier. Mo, just, it takes forever.
Mm.
And again, it sort of has that thing about nobody quite understands what they're doing. This is just going on and on and on. I think Mo, by the end, is a bit unnerved by the reaction.
Mm.
He's never seen anything like it. And he's beginning to realise that this might have gone horribly wrong and that sooner or later someone's going to stab them. Just terrifying. He shouts, long live King Mabel. And again, the last word ruining that for any sense of grandeur. But Mabel stands up and he's got a big sword and he's wearing a crown and he looks genuinely happy. I mean, it would be the best moment of his career for him. What is charming is when they actually sacked him, he went to one of the belt makers, Reggie Parks, and commissioned a King of the Ring belt to be made. And he used that on the independent circuit for many years.
That's hilarious.
Where he'd come in as the King of the Ring champion. And it said World Wrestling Federation, but it was like in Comic Sans. And then it had the King of the Ring logo on it.
Oh, wow.
And he would take that around with him everywhere he went. So he was very proud of that win, possibly in a way that no other winners were.
Yeah, okay.
And stuff like that makes my heart swell a bit. And I go, I like the fact that you were a fan of this. Very sweet.
Oh, wow.
We cut to Jerry Lawler vomiting into a sink. something he's probably spent quite a lot of the last year doing through nerves.
That is an atrocious looking sink.
It is. And the sick is genuinely realistic looking. They describe it as soda. I believe it's Coke. So it's Coke and Graham crackers mashed up. So you get those lumps that stick. That is one of the best things in the show. I go, genuine thing there that I go, if I see Coke and Graham crackers, I know I can make legitimate looking sick. And then we get Stephanie Weand doing a little interview with Psycho Sid, the Native American Tatanka. They're very keen to bill him as the Native American Tatanka,
right?
Because they don't want you to think he's not Native American. They're becoming a bit more aware of stuff at this point.
He looks so young because Tatanka's got like this. He's got the same face, but he's just extended out.
Yeah,
different directions.
And he looks quite handsome here. Mm. He looks dashing.
Yeah,
And he's also, this is one of the few times he actually does a not compelling, but a sensical sort of little bit of speaking.
Mm.
He conducts himself well. Mm. There's almost that thing slightly of people like Tatanka. Here he has found himself in the main event of a pay-per-view. And so I think he is probably thinking, this is the important moment where I've got to do this as well as possible. He just is one of the most boring wrestlers of all time. it's just bizarre how he's in the Million Dollar Corporation. And again, another boring stable.
Mm.
They're united under Ted DiBiase. Yeah. But what's the thing that unites them? We like money. We like money. Oh, well, good for you. what a great character note.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not Scrooge McDuck and you overplay it, if you're just someone who's like, you know, I love being paid for what I do. Yeah. Well, that's communism, you know. I mean, exactly that. Good man.
The I very much like the fact that Psycho Sid, for me, fell into almost doing a good promo and then fell back out of one and then back in and then out. He just couldn't stay on that horse. I was like, oh, come on,
Sid. And there's a bit where he goes, this is going well, and he's talking about Diesel's elbow and he goes, I heard it.
I heard it. Crunch, crunch, crunch.
He goes, I hear your elbow. I hear your soul. You would hold your mother for help. And who does he hold for help now? Bam Bam Bigelow. And I thought, again, in this situation, I would rather have Bam Bam Bigelow for support than my elderly mum. But the crunch, crunch, crunch bit. I love crunch, crunch, crunch. Look at me power bomb you land on your crunch, crunch, crunch. Crunch, 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 crunch. The match comes up. WWF champion Diesel and Bam Bam Bigelow.
Well, Diesel is
Sid and Tatanka.
In his preview, he's dressed like a member of the Cause. He's got a really flowery white shirt. He's got lovely hair.
Yeah.
Beautifully conditioned.
Yeah. I mean, my wife came in and she was like, Jesus Christ, is that Kevin Nash? And I was like, yeah. She said, he spent so long not having that dark hair, you know, and this is just basically a 3-year period in his career. This to me is still iconic Kevin Nash.
Mm.
He is beginning to become fun Diesel and he is beginning to let the Kevin Nashness come out of Diesel. So when he comes down to the ring, he's all like pointing at his elbow going, oh, it's fine, fine, it's fine, it's fine. And it's, I love watching how warm he is.
Yeah.
And how he's becoming this sort of, again, bringing the real Kevin Nash into a character which is a bit one-dimensional.
Mm.
What's brilliant about this is Bam Bam Bigelow. This is the moment for Bam Bam Bigelow where everything he's been promised is being delivered. So he's main evented WrestleMania 11, just gone against Lawrence Taylor, the celebrity. He has carried him to a perfectly decent match, even though Lawrence Taylor blows up within the first couple of minutes. Bam Bam has to do all the work. And so he has been rewarded by the WWE, who say, we are going to push you as a big baby face main eventer. And wonderful news, apart from the fact that Bam Bam is not very popular with Shawn Michaels.
Mm.
So Shawn Michaels believes that he is the star of WrestleMania 11 with Diesel. That should have been the main event. And that Bam Bam has sneaked his way into main eventing it and is getting all the credit and doesn't deserve it. So he will spend months just constantly telling everyone that Bam Bam Bigelow can't work, he shouldn't be there, he's fat, he's useless, and it works.
Mm.
So after a couple of months, Bam Bam Bigelow is gone. It's a tragedy because you see Bigelow come out here. It's amazing to think he first debuted with the WWE in 1987.
Right.
So we're looking at sort of 8 years. And at that point, they were like, he's going to be the next big babyface. When Hulk Hogan does the A cities, Bam Bam Bigelow will headline the B cities. And it never works. They push him too far. People get resentful about him. And he ends up just flopping.
Yeah.
He's got his second chance here. And he comes out and he's got this sort of new little waistcoat.
It's like those spitting dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, isn't it?
It's very much.
Kind of very colourful.
Like that. It's got a little nod to Bull Nakano as well, which is his sort of Japanese, like, you know, experience. And he comes out and again, a lot of people on the show can't stop smiling. Mabel, unprofessionally. But Bam Bam Bigelow, you can see he can taste this and that this is the future for him.
Yeah.
And he's hopeful about it. And he works hard in this match. Sid is naturally appalling. His music as well is really fucking horrible. Really horrible to listen to. Tatanka is bad. Diesel is really lazy in this match. He is not going to work hard.
I was looking at that. I was going, again, because we've not really seen a lot of him.
No.
Which I like Kevin Nash because I know what he's done afterwards. And, you know, he seems like an all right chap. But, like, I just think is Diesel actually bad at wrestling? I'm not sure.
He is. He was, certainly at one period, the least successful WWF champion of all time.
Yeah.
He is the champion at a point where the business is going down the toilet. And he is holding the can on that.
Mm.
Slightly the reason why Shawn Michaels isn't over keen to take the belt back.
Right.
Because things are going so badly, he doesn't want to be seen as the guy who was in, you know, basically at the nadir
of the whole.
Exactly.
Kind of,
you know, you don't want to be the guy who was left holding the bucket. So he's very keen for his good friend to keep that belt for a while they write everything. And hopefully, you know, when it picks up, he'll be champion again. but this match itself, I mean, I felt for Bigelow knowing what would happen because he really works hard in this. And it's just, it's a dismal match. Again, the people he's matched up against, what can you do with Tatanka and Sid? What could you do? And the other thing is that people obviously think that Diesel is a much bigger star, so they're more excited to see him. And Bam Bam is stuck between all of these different unlucky things that just mean that, you know, what is going to be really his biggest night probably of his career is actually the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
And it's just, oh, it's, I mean, what a disappointing way to end the worst pay-per-view you've ever watched, to see the one guy who is trying hard. Yeah, that you sort of go, and you'll be the person who basically everyone blames. Shawn Michaels will tell everyone that you are the reason this show flopped. You know, they put Bam Bam Bigelow on top and nobody wanted to see it.
Yeah.
Absolutely heartbreaking.
Atrocious.
So look, the good news is it's all better from here.
Yes, okay, right.
And the good news is we are at the bottom. It is a thrilling period that I think, if someone said to you, you could work in any period of wrestling, it'd be very easy to say, I'd like to work at WWE when they're doing national expansion, or I'd like to do it, you know, when, you know, The Miz was riding high as WWE champion. I can't imagine a better time to have worked in this business than coming in the day before this show.
Yeah.
That would be the dream.
Yeah.
And getting to watch how it all, by total fucking accident, turned into billion-dollar businesses is just the most thrilling period. What's fun is that WCW are in a similarly bad position. And again, they don't know that a year away is salvation. 1995 is the year that both WCW and WWE could have just shut up shop. And instead, they will go on to a success that no wrestling company has ever seen before or since. Thrilling, Peter!
Lovely old job.
Oh, lovely stuff. And we are going to be working this out in a clever way so that we can really hit that proper moment where we get King of the Ring 96 and we get Bash at the Beach 96. And I think that's going to form an exciting double live show, Pete.
Yes.
Two shows, same day. It's WrestleMania 4. Double video cassette because it was so long. Right? Tagged Classic, they're calling it, Pete, based on the DVDs where they repackaged them and put them onto DVD that had previously been on videos, and nobody bought them, even though they turned out to be the best, most uncut versions consequently. This is the WrestleMania Tagged Classic, and it's going to be taking place at the London Podcast Festival this year.
In September,
we will be building up to that for the rest of the summer. And I tell you what, I'm fucking excited.
I'm really looking forward to summer.
I'm so excited to be in a bit of wrestling where you go, we're going to see it bloom. Because it feels like we've been watching it since we've started. We started in 89, we worked our way through to about 93. And what we've been watching is we've been watching it get worse and worse and worse. And now is the time, Pete, that you're going to get to visit the moment that every wrestling fan still talks about, that every wrestling fan wishes would come back, and that every wrestling fan's been unable to get over.
Yeah.
Not just wrestling fans, the whole business. The business has been unable to get over it. WWE still celebrates the Attitude Era more than any other period in its history. And it's because it's the best.
What the world is watching.
The tagline of this one.
It's a tagline.
Did you know the tagline for this?
No.
I think it's something like Guts and Glory.
Guts and
Glory. Not even related.
Guts
you know?
And, yeah.
I would have said, it's a King thing.
Oh, yes, wonderful. Oh, love it. Well, we'll be back next week as we continue our journey out of the entrails of shit that we've been kind of...
And into an entirely different three letters of shit, WCW. We're going to be taking one of their 1995 pay-per-views.
Okay.
We might do Uncensored 95, again, seen as being the worst output of the entire history of their pay-per-views.
Cool.
Oh, look. Delightful shit. Come and wallow, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for supporting us. We love you. Wrestling back.
WrestleMe is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.